maybe one quick question, then the next presentation, and then we'll have questions after the discussions at the end, okay? So each person has 15 minutes, and first person up is Steve Fuller, who is going to talk about beyond academic rentiership.
Okay.
Sorry, it's actually
blinding
us. Yeah. Oh dear.
Yeah.
Blinded by the light.
I know. No, it's not my brilliance doing it this time. No, it's the light. No, okay.
I just said the light.
All right. Okay. Well, look, first of all, I want to thank Keane for organizing the two sessions on technoscientific rent. I noticed that the audience for this one is largely different from the last one. So it might be useful to raise a few issues. And I want to start by saying that I have actually been interested in this topic for a long time, and I wrote a book called Knowledge Management Foundations, was published in 2002, where I actually put forward the idea of rent as being one of the sources of value from knowledge, especially academic knowledge. Okay. Now, this idea is not original to me completely, in the sense that it does have precedent. And as one of the things that we were discussing in the previous session was the kind of negative connotation of the concept of rent in all the major economic traditions, whether we're talking about classical liberalism or we're talking about Marxism, all of them regard rent as a kind of negative thing, perhaps for somewhat different reasons. When the idea of rent seeking, the phrase rent seeking, was specifically applied to academic knowledge production, the first time that gets used is in the 1960s from the public choice school, George Mason University, those kinds of people. Gordon Tullock, some of you may know about Gordon Tullock, who was a co-author with James Buchanan in some of the major works of public choice theory, actually quite explicitly introduced the idea that academic knowledge production was rent-seeking, looking at it from a purely economic standpoint. Okay, so in other words, what's the intuition that's behind the claim? It's basically the idea that, unlike other, you might, if in a sense your bottom line notion of what knowledge is, as a public good or something like that, is it actually enables people to produce more, to in some way flourish, to benefit, and so forth, then the question that's going to be asked immediately from an economic standpoint is what are the barriers in the way of getting access to this, given that in fact this is something that is necessary, that everybody agrees, for people to flourish, to be more productive, whatever you take to be the normative goals. Gordon Tullock just basically said, look, the fact that people have to get credentials is itself a form of rent seeking. Right, so there's a sense in which the fact that you have to go to school, and in other words, the kind of and the way in which, so there's no denial that academic knowledge is useful or productive in some whatever sense you want to define it. So it's not like there's a denigration of academic knowledge per se going on, but rather the way in which you end up getting access requires jumping through so many hoops. It actually costs you so much, not only financially, but in terms of the amount of time it takes. Right, in terms of the other things you need to master first before you actually get to what really is important to you that can make a difference in your life, right, that this is all part of the rent-seeking side of academia, to create this kind of blockage, right, which everyone in a sense is forced to go through, because and this has a lot to do with the role of credentials in society. That's the other part of it, right? So in other words, while you might say that in principle it's possible to get access to the kind of knowledge that academics have through other means, like nowadays we might think about the internet and so forth as ways of finding out about knowledge without having to pay tuition fees and so forth, and there are lots of different levels at which you can enter in to find out about knowledge given where your starting point is, so in that sense it's very friendly to multiple access. But at the same time, in order for you to get credit for having the knowledge, that's where the credentialing part comes in. You need to get the degree. You need to get an academic to, sprinkle fairy dust over you in the form of diplomas and things like this. And so I'm putting this picture very vividly on the table because this is what Gordon Tullock is talking about, okay? And when economists think about this kind of stuff, very often what they have in the back of their mind is the way in which knowledge actually was significant in creating the kind of economic step change that we call the Industrial Revolution, where, if you know, because that was in a sense a kind of knowledge-based revolution, but it wasn't knowledge that was being generated directly from the academies, but rather it were these very enterprising people who were kind of in correspondence with academics, so they were trying to get academic knowledge, but you might say on the cheap, as it were, by corresponding with them and by putting together their own knowledge and then coming up with innovations and inventions that end up actually generating an enormous amount of capital and boosting the economy and so forth. And so from that standpoint, right, you know, that is a revolution that largely occurred, you know, with academics on the sidelines. They weren't completely absent, but they were bit players, okay? Now, the interesting thing, if you look at the history of science, the institutionalization of science, natural science, in the 19th century, in response to the Industrial Revolution, and this is where somebody like William Whewell becomes very important. Some of you may know about William Whewell. He's the man who coined the word scientist in the English language in the 1830s. And this was part of the idea of in a way, trying to, you know, for academics to kind of take control of the situation. Because in a sense, all the productive knowledge was happening outside of the universities. And the academics had no role, as it were, in terms of certifying or any kind of setting standards or anything of that kind. So what you need to do is you need to say, ah, yes, well, all those inventions and things may be created by guys outside the academy, but how do they don't really know the fundamental principles by which those things work. These are just kind of basically tested in the marketplace. Some work, some don't. And it's all just about trial and error and track record. But in the university, if you actually go to study in the university, you will get principled, credentialed understanding. You will be licensed to do the kind of work that now all these guys at the moment are just doing on the hoof. And so this is where the university starts to regain its power, and it's through the credentialing process and the coinage of the word scientist as the name of a specific profession that in a sense it requires a kind of mastery of a certain kind of abstract knowledge and so forth in order to be licensed to do the kinds of things that can be productive knowledge in society. That is something that it's a slow process, but it begins in the 1830s, and by the end of the 19th century, it's largely accomplished, okay? And then the universities, in a way, recover their lost advantage, you might say. But it's through a rent, you know, it's a recreation of rent, right? That's what they basically have done. Because in the past, the academics, in a way, were rent-seeking in the sense that insofar as universities were tied to religious authorities that were tied to the state, right, that the universities were rent seekers that way. They were providing the credentials in that kind of a world where the epistemic authority flowed that way. But now in this new world where the epistemic authority is flowing from science, the universities have to reinvent themselves in their rent-seeking mold, and this is where you get the credential society, right, the credentialing going on. So that's the principal form of rent-seeking, okay, is credentialing. And but of course there are other aspects to this. It isn't just the getting of the formal degrees, but the process that you have to undergo in order to get the degrees. Not only do they cost money and they take time, potentially time taken away from doing properly productive work, and this argument, of course, gets made all the time now, but also in terms of the way in which you go about getting the access to the knowledge, right? And this is where the issue of things like academic disciplines, the very specialized paths, right? I mean, one of the things that we know about history of academic disciplines, which are provide the structure for the university, is that these are path-dependent things. The fact that disciplines have developed the way they did, the fact that they've got the language that they have, the jargons that they have, the concepts that they have, right? Even though if you look at all the disciplines, you can tell sort of at a distance that a lot of their domains are kind of overlapping. It's not like they're mutually exclusive in any ontological sense, so it's not like the disciplines are cutting the world at the joints. Right, that's not what's going on with. It's largely path-dependent things that have been allowed to colonize various kinds of spaces in different ways, in different countries, in different places, and so this then becomes kind of the fine structure of the rentiership of academic culture, and people have to go through these disciplinary pathways in order to get the credentials that then enable them afterwards to do whatever productive stuff they do in the in the society. Okay. So that's the kind of overall picture of academic rentiership that we're talking about here, okay? This is actually, you know, so if you're good, now, as I mentioned at the beginning, by the way, how much more time do I have? I know I'm enthralling you, but you're not telling me anything.
We have about 7 minutes.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm not going over time. That one of the things that we were emphasizing in the first session and I mentioned in the beginning of the talk here is that rent is normally seen as this negative thing. Now, if we continue to hold that view, and then we look at how academic culture is being portrayed in this picture, then almost all the distinctive features of academic culture, that is to say, that distinguishes it from other forms of knowledge producing in other places in society, is rent-seeking. I mean, that's what it looks like, right, in the picture that I'm portraying here. And this is not something that, as it were, is merely a counterintuitive theoretical insight or something like this, but it's in fact something that has become apparent, for example, to prospective employers and people like this. So some of you may know that a year or two ago now, Ernst & Young, one of the major accounting firms in the UK, the accounting firms have these entry tests that people have to take in order to enter the field. But typically, you can't actually take those tests unless you have a certain degree, a college, some sort of university degree, right? Maybe quite specific university degree. Well, they eliminated that requirement. This is the point. They've eliminated that requirement. So they have cut out that rent-seeking side of the issue. And what they have done is they have allowed people, whatever university, if any, qualifications they have, to actually directly take the test. Okay? That's a pretty bold move. But that is a great example. You see, that is the kind of thing that, in a sense, especially if you're talking about somebody like Gordon Tullock, who talked about academic culture as rent-seeking, that is exactly the kind of thing that you would want to do. You would want to eliminate all of these kind of, what is the value added of having the degree from what can be scoped out by just giving somebody an examination on the things you actually want them to do, right? Because there is this general kind of problem, and this is where what I'm working my way to here is that there's a sense in which the value of academic knowledge is academic knowledge is under serious question if you take the rentership view seriously, because it is the kind of thing that people are increasingly being motivated to find ways around to overcome, to eliminate. Okay, so if the primary value of academic knowledge lies in the credentialing process, as it is understood at the moment, it is a fair game target for the kind of thing that Gordon Tullock wanted to eliminate. And already we see things like these accounting firms doing that. Because the original idea of academic, from an economist standpoint, whatever value having a degree has, from a purely economic standpoint, if you're one of these neoclassical, neoliberal guys that Larry Bush was railing against in the last session, right, the purpose of a degree is as a market signaling device, right? So in other words, by knowing what degree and what subject you got, you come from, you save a lot of trouble from the employer having to do additional stuff like interviewing people and putting them through various tests and so forth. The problem is that the kind of knowledge that people actually learn in universities through this credentialing thing has actually, in a way, diverged so much from the actual knowledge and skills that are needed for the jobs that people are being employed in, right, that in a sense this rent-seeking has gained too much of an autonomy from what it could have actually functioned in terms of market signal. Now, you see, if you're a free market liberal, that's a nightmare, right? That's a market signal that doesn't work, right? You're supposed to say anyone who's got a degree from this place is going to do great at my job, and you find out, no, they don't. You just have to retrain them all over again. So why require that they have gone to university in the first place? You see, this is rent-seeking in action, right? We're, in a sense, a lot of useless time and money and effort, right? Again, so this is what Tullock is going for. And of course, I think you're going to, we are seeing, because of high tuition fees, all the other things negative features of academia that seem to be accumulating in our culture in the moment, not only for financial reasons, but also for ideological reasons, right, are adding up to a kind of story where there's a question about whether there is value to academic knowledge beyond rent-seeking, right? So in other words, so this is the question that I would say is on the table. And my view here, and this is where it starts to perhaps get a little controversial. My answer is yes, that there is, but it really does require that academics take seriously. They have to engage in the process, and this is where education, I think, plays a very important role. At the moment, the way we tend to structure our education systems is actually to make people so dependent on certain kinds of technical language, discipline-based languages and so forth, that in a sense we kind of perhaps incapacitate them, kind of in a way Thorstein Veblen, you know, talked about learned incapacity, trained incapacity, if you remember that, right? That in a sense, you know, people are supposed to be trained to be able to work in the world, but the way we do it is in such a narrow focused way that while they get kind of what we're doing, right, and we're able to give them the first class honors degrees and things like that, the fact is that they're actually not good for anything else. And so unless what we are trying to do is just reproduce ourselves endlessly, okay, then we're, you know, there's a sense in which the value of academic knowledge is not being fully displayed, especially as a so-called public good. And this is where I would argue that in fact, what academics should shift, they should shift from this highly specialized form of teaching, where you basically indoctrinate people into a very path-dependent way of getting at knowledge, and actually, in a way, present knowledge in a much more public and open fashion. So in other words, deconstruct the textbooks, right? In a way, you might say, reduce the level of technicality, reduce the jargon, right? And I actually think, so give you one fairly bold proposal. There are a lot of proposals I have, but given that we have limited time, I'll just give you one example. One of the ways in which, of course, we kind of manifest the sort of path dependency of knowledge and the way in which you might say all the rent-seeking activities go on is through the citation culture. And this is something that Keane mentioned in his opening talk this morning. And yet we live in a world, right, with the internet and so forth, that in principle we actually have multiple ways of accessing, trying to make sense of the knowledge that we read about, let's say in a journal article and so forth, which opens the question as to why do we need to cite people at all? Right? Why do you know? In other words, rather than say we're going to have to be citing forever, why not take the fact that now we actually have we have different ways of accessing the same sort of knowledge that actually allow the reader the kind of freedom to find their own way into the topic and not always have to be signposted in the text, right? Given that they do have the internet always there with them already, right? And they're already always plugged into it. And so that can actually be a very big democratizing move that ends up destroying a lot of the path dependencies of knowledge production that at the moment our academic culture reinforces. Okay, so should I stop there? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think there are two issues here. The issue, there is an issue. If we take the proposal I make seriously, then we do have to be concerned about internet governance. Because, I mean, I guess for me, the issue isn't so much that, you know, Google owns the internet or whatever, but rather the fact that Google can govern it in its own way, pretty much, you know, unregulated. That's more of the problem, because then that does end up skewing the kind of access that people have in terms of the, you know, the ordering and the Google searches and stuff like that, and that is problematic for sure. But I think that if we as academics, right? So in other words, I'm talking about this as a kind of that we as academics, in a way, need to incorporate stuff like Google and the internet as part of our remit. In other words, we have to, in some way, feel that we're responsible for that. That Google is not the other in a sense, but it's actually part of the means by which we will self-democratize and remove the rent-seeking tendencies that I think in principle can end up undermining the academia as we know it. So in other words, we need to kind of lay a claim, as it were, to setting a certain kind of standard to the internet. That's the way I would go, rather than just proliferating the citation culture.
Okay, so we're going to hold off questions.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
We're also going to hold off questions until after the discussion.
Okay.
So if you have questions, you can ask.